Hi, welcome to a special issue of Barnstorming PA and Jola Politics. That's Joey Ola. This is your regular Barnstorming podcast host, Jordy. Joey is a student at Elizabethtown College and reached out to me about doing a pre-debate video show. This was a bit of an experiment and our first attempt to do multi-camera video. Didn't quite work out, but we were able to capture this audio in which we talk about the debate format, what we'd like to see, and we dig in a little bit about Pete Buttigieg and some other candidates. So if you like this, please visit JOLAH Politics at YouTube and, of course, Barnstorming PA. Enjoy the show. Oh, I should also say it cuts off at the end a little bit quickly because, as we're always doing a bit of guerrilla podcasting and recording and media productions, I was stowed away in a classroom at a university taking advantage of their blazing fast internet, and the next class started to come in, so I had to scurry away. Thanks.
All right, so the first question I usually ask of the debates after watching the last one and seeing the opening question, they said, to save time, we're not going to let you have opening remarks. We're just going to go into this first question about the impeachment process. And I thought it was a little drawn out because obviously every candidate on stage is for the impeachment process. So, like, in your opinion, do you think they should go really deep into the impeachment process tonight? Because all of them will probably be repeating the same sentiments.
I don't think they should go into it very much. I think, because who's going to be watching this? It's mostly hardcore political people. They probably know a lot about the impeachment, and they're more interested in how people present themselves when they're planning to run. And they're probably also sensitive to the idea that, the punditocracy, the pundit class, is going to be talking about how much the average voter doesn't cares about bread and butter issues. So they don't want to get pulled into the narrative that they're obsessed about the Beltway. And also, I don't know how effective the Republican framing is that is trying to undo the election of 2016. But I think for the candidates, they're better off letting Congress and the congressional Republicans on this because it's part of their job to do.
But I know Rachel, like, Maddow is hosting, so I'm
Right.
guessing she's gonna bring it up because that's probably what they're instructing her to do.
Well,
But
that's a, I don't know. I mean, who decides the questions? Is it her? Is it her producers?
well, if it's their producers, then they're almost definitely going to do that because they've been pushing this narrative forever. Although they ask candidates all of the time, do what are voters saying about the impeachment process? And all of the candidates will say, well, they aren't asking about that. They want to know about what we're going to do for jobs or healthcare.
Yeah, I would find it very frustrating as one of these candidates. I mean, I did see yesterday 70% of Americans in some poll that what the president did wrong. I think that that's working. I mean, all along I thought, if you do impeachment inquiry in the right way, it will change public opinion. This idea that, kind of look at current polls, extrapolate about any issue, Americans do or don't like it this way. Yeah, I'm like, whoa, that's always a flaw because you're dealing with. I wanted to maybe half a step back. Like, I don't like the debate formats at all. I'm constantly frustrated at the extent to which the companies put themselves. I don't know how to generate the questions, right? Like, I would love more transparency about that. And I feel like the media should both off. I mean, in 2016, maybe also earlier. And some other kind of relying on memory, they would have some debates in different formats, or they would create mechanisms for crowd-generated questions. But I don't know that anything like that is happening tonight. I was thinking about us getting on the video call. Like, I would love for them to have a contest where they take 100 questions or 15 questions and let people vote on their favorite three or something like that. And also, last summer I was at Networks Nation, which was the conference of activists and progressive, and let's see, Warren there, who's the guy who was running on the environment a lot, dropped out from Washington.
Inslee?
Inslee, thank you. Hensley was there, Warren was there, Julian Castro, maybe two others.
Okay.
And they would do like 15 minutes total with guy Marcos, I can't remember his last name, the guy who started Daily Phones.
Mm-hmm.
And so they would do some minutes of him in a more conversational, and then a couple questions from on an activist. And I just think, like, I learned more about each candidate. Like, Jay Inslee, I was like, well, I know a lot more about him. And I'm honestly, I'm kind of sad he dropped out. I thought he was interesting.
Okay.
And, yeah, so I'm big on, call it a debate. That's silly. How do you have a debate? How many people?
Yeah, there's 10 tonight.
10. Or they have a debate with 10.
Yeah, I agree. I think that an ideal format would be for C-SPAN to host every debate, no live audience, because that just changes the way people talk. Because if politicians are speaking in front of an audience, they'll frame everything they say to rise up like this, and this is why I'm going to do that, and expect right. an applause. And right. people laugh at like Joe Rogan and all these long-form new media interviewers, but you really learn a lot about the candidates during these.
Right.
They should just
right.
give them a topic and say, here, all of you discuss right. this, and just have a right. moderator so there's no filibuster.
Right. Yeah, for sure. Or, you know, I was imagining, because there is a big deal, you could do something like some hybrid, what you and I were talking about, like for two nights, you know, 90 minutes total. The first night, the person gets 10 minutes, go like one, you know, in order, in whatever order, a random order, and then 2 weeks later revisit it and just reverse the order.
Mm.
And so then they would have the chance to use, if they want to use their time to differentiate themselves from another candidate, they could do that instead of being boxed into, you know, we, because the thing is always trying to create attention, like, you know, do you dislike this person or do you want to challenge
them? Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially with something like healthcare, it could let like Mayor Pete get away with just saying Medicare for all who want it and just say we could have this beautiful plan that's so idealistic to the point that everyone can have their whole their own absolute choice, plus everyone can be covered, which simply isn't replicated anywhere in the world. And systems like that don't work in practice. And there's no debate on like single payer either. Like there's no debate on the form of single payer, Australian method versus Canadian method versus the nationalized method in the UK versus our free market method, which has been terrible. Like there's no actual debate on that. It's just a bunch of platitudes. And then throughout the week after the debates, the media will end up reinforcing whatever idea they want. That's why we see, and this is going into the next topic, Joe Biden, after every single debate, his numbers drop terribly. But then a couple weeks after the debate, once the media can build him back up, the numbers recover.
Right.
So yeah, what do you think about, like, why is Joe Biden?
I think it's a simple, uninteresting answer. That's name recognition. Yeah. I heard a little bit today, the Times does a daily, it's called the Daily. They had a couple of people heard it. It's pretty good stuff. They had a couple of the reporters following Kamala Harris in South Carolina, and their question was, what happened to her? But embedded in that was talking to, they brought up the kind of elephant in the room question. For African-American voters in South Carolina, which is a huge chunk of the Democratic electorate there, are uneasy with color. So that's one reason why Kamala Harris has a tougher room with the hoe. I mean, to them, Obama was great and exception. And I think, you know, for me, I don't know for you, like it seemed like the Obama presidency, like I never believed in a war past race, but it did seem like that broke a certain barrier, right? Mm-hmm. So I would assume, yeah, another British color can win. But I can understand if you're like experienced through 60 or 70, that he was the exception. But that's so that either both women and women of color have a tougher time. You know, they were interviewing one, and it's just one person. But, you know, there's an older black woman saying, and the question was, do you think that black men would have a hard time voting for anyone, white or black? And she went, yeah, they expect to be in charge.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, intersectionality, ungainly word for a very important topic. So I think Joe Biden, you know, gets name recognition plus this electability thing.
It's always 45% of voters say their main issue is picking a candidate who can beat Donald Trump.
Right.
And then that's obviously subjective because there's two ways that we could attack this. We can either go for a centrist candidate, which I've said many times. The last five times we tried that, we lost as a Democratic side. Or we can go for a candidate that tries to expand the base and be more populist and put more progressive policies in. And of course, the establishment will go for the centrist, then the people will go for the more progressive people.
Right. So I mean, what do you see Tom Steyer, Patrick, Bloomberg, does that fit into your analysis that they're coming into the race later?
Well, I think they're coming into the race to try to split up the vote and fragment it even more. I don't think they want any candidate getting too much of a state's share in delegates, because I think no matter what, they want to force a contested convention so that it goes to a second ballot so they could pick who the candidate is with their superdelegates.
Oh, I thought they got rid of superdelegates.
Nope, they just pushed them back to the second ballot.
Oh.
So if Democrats, if no one hits the number, then guess what? They get to pick who's the nominee.
Huh. I mean, I'm torn. I'm torn between just purely the political theatrical side of me is like a contested convention would be awfully interesting.
I think it would make them lose the election. If say Warren or Sanders carried the delegates and then they switch it to Pete or Biden, they would lose so many votes. It'd be over.
Oh yeah, I agree. It'd be like Chicago at 68. You know, and that kind of fracture between establishment and grassroots. It's always interesting. I think the establishment maybe has two components too, right? Sometimes it's more economic elites. So about, you know, the pivot during Clinton's ascendancy, that kind of centrism, it was trying to be appealed to the perspective of the economy, finance. But then there's another part, and especially, you know, I feel like it's kind of like an issue, just about protecting incumbents. So I'm a little rusty on my 68 politics. You know, a lot about sort of anti-war energy is, in my sense, trying to push into the convention and Chicago with Billy Elder not wanting to happen with that.
Mm-hmm.
So I haven't lost the thread here, but I mean, I don't want to. I mean, I get furious about superdelegates. I just, I have a mother-in-law who I love dearly, who's been very involved in Democratic politics for her whole life, and she and I go toe-to-toe on this, right? And she's like, well, you know, what if you have a candidate? This basically comes down to, what if the people fuck up? Oh, can I say that?
I don't care.
Okay. You know, what if the people fuck up? And I'm like, and think about a quote-unquote bad candidate, and she sort of imagines, you know, the people could accidentally elect some or nominate somebody who I don't know. She brings up some example of somebody who would have in the 50s, maybe, I think, that had a history of mental health. And I'm like, first of all,
Donald Trump.
Donald
Trump.
Okay, yeah, right. No candidate gets very far these days without all of the dirt being up. And it's so anti-populist, so anti,
Well, that's really interesting, too, because the way the founders designed our Constitution, they actually wanted it to be decided by the House. Like, since if no candidate gets enough electoral votes, then it goes to a House vote. And they didn't expect a winner-take-all system. They didn't expect a two-party system. So the founders of our Constitution actually did follow those guidelines, the anti-populist, because they did not believe in people governing themselves.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And there's a whole other thing that they want to get interested in. State Constitution, Commonwealth Constitution, was written at the same time. Do you know about this?
No.
Constitution. There's a C-SPAN Lectures in History series. That's really good. Right. The gist of it that I got from this one is the Pennsylvania original Constitution was way more populist. So in the same building in Philadelphia, in one Independence Hall, then it was House, had one wing, they were discussing the Constitution and building in what you're saying, the Electoral College, the House of Representatives, and literally in the same building had a far more radical kind of Thomas Paine type people saying, oh, everyone should be able to vote. It doesn't matter about property. So there were these quotes in this podcast of, I can't remember exactly, maybe Benjamin Rush was one, people who were on the historical record being a founding father, how great democracy is, about the U.S. Constitution, saying about the Pennsylvania Constitution, who let these nincompoops decide, literally, that's the word, who let these nincompoops decide that people should have a vote?
Yeah.
So it captured this tension. And to go with what you're saying, I think Americans, the system we've inherited is a kind of a sort of a populist system, parties that's been, you know, bolted onto the electoral machinery that the Constitution put in place.
Mm-hmm.
I don't always understand that. You know, we're always a little bit, until 2000, you know, I was 28 in 2000. I was like, electrocologist is kind of a thing. It doesn't really matter. And then suddenly, there's other stuff about this, right? At 2000, the electoral college decided it. 2000, I think the electoral college decided it. So we have two elections, and where it does matter. But that's just about the House representative.
Yeah, the way our elections are going and the way the our involvement is going would actually fit a PPR system more, where we'd have multiple parties and proportional representation, which we're not going to do. So it's interesting to see how it's coalescing with the electoral system that's meant to be a basic guide rails for the citizens in case if we mess up, right. Which I guess Donald Trump could be an example of, because you can't control a populist demagogue. And right. Like, and the president of the United States is interesting because aside from, like, of course, parliament that has a head of state and a head of government, the president is a combination of the two, which is a big issue because being a head of state, which is the ideological figurehead of a nation, gives them the power invested that wasn't in the executive branch. So that's what we're seeing right now with Donald Trump and even FDR going across the country and having this like cult-like effect on the people.